Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong, a professor of neuroscience and also proprietor of the Princeton Election Consortium, election.princeton.edu.
So we are in midterm season. The midterms are really are right upon us. Everyone is talking about it. Sam and I are certainly thinking about it. It's been a lot of interesting developments. Certainly the campaigns, the races seem to be tightening. There has been movement in both parties. We've seen a lot of indications that Republicans are looking at better prospects right now, or pretty good prospects in the Senate. In the House, there's indications it was going better for the Republicans, now swinging back a bit to Democrats. But things are up in the air, and this is going to be a major midterm to see what happens in terms of the balance of power in Washington, in terms of the kind of values judgment that comes from the electorate, in terms of where the parties are on the nuts and bolts of mobilization, and as we'll discuss a little today, demobilization. What effect do some of the voting restrictions we've seen have as these elections play out in the next few weeks? So let's unpack some of those issues. Our guest is Barry Yeoman, who's a freelance journalist who also teaches at Duke University. Barry's work has appeared in many outlets, The American Prospect, City Lab, Discover, Glamour, The Huffington Post, Mother Jones, The Nation, The New Republic, and more. Barry's articles have received a lot of praise, including from the Columbia Journalism Review, which named him one of nine investigative reporters who are, quote, out of the spotlight but on the mark. So today we're here to talk about a really fascinating article that Barry wrote that Sam and I caught our attention in Talking Points Memo. It's called "The North Carolina GOP is Trying Every Trick to Keep a Supreme Court Seat." So we're really looking forward to discussing the piece. And Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So maybe we can just start by telling us, if you could tell us a little bit about who Anita Earls is, who's the focus of the article, and what's going on in North Carolina.
Sure. So I think that if you want to understand Anita Earls, you have to understand the bigger picture of what's happening in North Carolina. We have been leaders through the late 90s and early aughts in expanding voting rights through things such as same-day registration and youth pre-registration. 16 and 17-year-olds are allowed to sign up in high school and be automatically eligible. And starting in 2011, when the Republicans took over the North Carolina State Legislature, they began a pretty systematic rollback of voting rights. And this, of course, was heavily litigated. And the main force for the voting rights supporters' courtroom strategy was the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, which is a nonprofit which Anita Earle founded in 2007. She has been a civil rights lawyer in North Carolina for 30 years. She worked for Julius Chambers' law firm. She worked for the Department of Justice. And she and her organization have been in the forefront of pushing back against every effort to roll back voting rights, to impose a really sort of outrageous political gerrymandering. And so her name is fundamentally associated with voting rights advocacy in North Carolina. And she is now running for the one seat on the state Supreme Court that is up for re-election in 2018. She's running as a Democrat. She's running against a Republican incumbent. And if she wins, then a state which has a Republican supermajority in the legislature will have a 5-2 Democratic-Republican split on the state Supreme Court. And that, of course, would serve as a corrective to whatever the next strategy is for the Republicans in the legislature to roll back voting rights here in North Carolina.
And just for the context, the story that you're telling of North Carolina and voting rights since 2011 is one we've heard in other states as well. How does North Carolina compare in terms of these initiatives to disenfranchise and restrict voters? How does it compare to some of the other states that have been involved in this kind of activity?
We've been pretty audacious here in North Carolina. Certainly there have been, you know, similar stories out of places like Texas. But North Carolina has felt like the strategy is to just throw every possible method against the wall and see what sticks. And because North Carolina has a bad track record in terms of voting rights, going back 125 years, we had a coup in 1898 where the Democrats, who were the white supremacists, tried overthrowing a fusion black-white government in Wilmington, North Carolina. So we have a very long history, and it makes what's happened since 2011 really historically resonant. And so in 2013, the state legislature passed a massive repeal of every voting rights reform. They passed a voter ID requirement that is so strict that even state-issued college ID cards are not valid. They cherry-picked which IDs African-American voters are more likely to hold and made them ineligible for voter ID. Most of this has been thrown out in court. And at the same time, we have taken gerrymandering to kind of an extreme. This is a purple state. This is a 50-50 state. And before the 2010 census, the Democrats had a slight edge in Congress in North Carolina. And now there are 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats representing North Carolina in Congress. And when the chair of the House Elections Committee was asked why he created a map which would cause a 10-3 split, he said, "It's because I wanted to have an 11-2 split, but that's not possible."
Right. So I think it's important to note that here this shift from 8-5 in one direction to 10-3 in the other direction was quite sudden. And so what that rules out is a common idea, which is that that partisan advantages in a map arise from where voters live and where they're clustered. And so to have such a massive swing in a single election is not from moving of people, but rather moving of lines around the people.
Right. We are a state that is becoming more heavily minority and more urban, and those are conditions that normally favor Democrats. And so the shift in who represents us in Congress is really counter to what's happening in the population as a whole.
Well, let's turn to a little bit of background here. You've pointed out the close partisan division in North Carolina, which leads to things like one party trying really hard to hold on to power, especially if its electoral base is eroding. But another factor that is really prominent in North Carolina is that its state constitution is kind of peculiar. And so getting back to the Anita Earls candidacy, or linking back to the Anita Earls candidacy, the state constitution puts very few bounds on the legislature's power. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So we are a state that has a very weak executive branch. We have a governor who only got the veto recently and still has no line item veto. The appointment powers rest heavily in the legislature. And since the Republican takeover in 2011, there's been claiming of more and more appointment powers. And on top of that, even when the governor got the veto, we only need a 3/5 majority to override.
Right.
And that's the low bar. It's 60% instead of the normal at 2/3. And because we have supermajorities in both chambers, who got into office in 2011, redistricted themselves.
Because the governor doesn't have to sign the plan.
Right. We really end up with the legislature that, if not for the courts, would pretty much be able to do anything it wanted.
Right. And so consequently, the Anita Earls race is important because it sets up the one check on the legislative's power.
Right.
So let's see. One more point. Now, turning to the election that's happening pretty imminently, the North Carolina legislature has put referenda on the ballot. Now, just to interject here, there is also no way for voters to put initiatives on the ballot directly. Initiatives go from the legislature, so they're called referenda. So these things go from the legislature to the ballot. Voters don't have a direct say, which is also a lack of recourse. But the legislature has put on some pretty interesting initiatives on the ballot that people are going to be voting on in North Carolina. And those seem to fit in well with what you're talking about with voting rights.
Yes. So there are 6 questions on the ballot. 3 are pretty directly involving voting rights. 1 is a new pass at voter ID. It's very vaguely worded. It has no reference to what would qualify as a valid ID. And, you know, people generally favor voter ID. You know, people
sounds
people,
good.
Yeah, it sounds great. People think there's fraud. There is almost no fraud. And since there is no specifics, it will then allow the legislature to come back and say which IDs are legal, which are not. And now they have guidance of the courts, so they can fall in, you know, just shy of what would be unconstitutional. Of the other 2 questions that are relevant are both about appointments. One would give the legislature, rather than the governor, who has it now, the power to appoint judges if there's a vacancy. This is really important for 2 reasons. One is we have a lot of vacancies. Many judges, and I couldn't find an exact statistic, but many judges who come to power are first appointed because of another judge stepping down. And they may have to face election later, but then they have the advantage of being incumbents. The second reason this is important is that the legislature is allowed to pack the courts. And so the theory that the Democrats have articulated and the Republicans have not denied is that if Earls loses, that is, if the incumbent Republican Barbara Jackson wins, then the Democrats have a 4-3 advantage. The legislature comes back, and because the amendment to the Constitution has been approved, let's say, they add another couple of seats to the court, they appoint Republicans, and there is a 5-4 majority, Republican majority, which is in place when redistricting happens in 2021. And so any outrageous redistricting plan is protected from the intervention of the Supreme Court.
This is obviously a state story in North Carolina, but we've all lived through the Supreme Court version of this battle not long ago. How much coordination have you found between the National Republican Party and the state Republican Party in terms of pushing both for these kinds of restrictions and building the support that's necessary, and also in terms of the campaign against Earl? Is there a lot of court? Is this a national effort like we saw in 2010 when the Republicans mobilized to do well in the states to set all this up?
So I have not found a national coordination. Mm-hmm. The 2010 story is, of course, instructive because there was the Red Map plan that identified key states that were generally purple but Democratic legislatures, and it invested heavily in those states. It invested $1.2 million into North Carolina, and suddenly these quiet state House and state Senate races, which were, you know, normally $5,000 races, suddenly became $100,000 races where a Democratic incumbent, a small town mayor, a conservative Democrat, would be accused of being a tax and spend Barack Obama liberal. And it worked. There was, of course, a big rebellion against Obama in 2010 nationwide, and that's what swept in our legislature. I have not seen the same kind of coordination of effort, but that does not mean it's not there.
Well, one way to think about it is that it strikes me, I lived in North Carolina for several years, but still, I passed through. But it strikes me that there's a lot of local interest on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, and there's just a lot of local activism and local power structure making North Carolina its own place. And so if you look on the progressive side, it'll be groups like Black Churches, the Moral Mondays movement. And on the other side, people like Art Pope, these sort of larger-than-life figures who play such a strong role in North Carolina politics. So what this year, playing out against this national backdrop of this big wave of opinion where the president is pretty unpopular at the moment, how is that playing out in North Carolina? What have you noticed? What are you seeing on the ground?
Well, certainly the left here it's highly mobilized. Folks are incensed. They are well organized. Of course, Reverend Barber, who was the leader of the state NAACP and leader of the Moral Monday movement, has gone on to lead the Poor People's Campaign, and that's had a very strong presence in North Carolina. And so the energy among North Carolina mainstream Democrats and outside of the party progressives has been very, very strong. The North Carolina Republican Party has been a spectacle. It's been not shying away from tapping into the biggest fears of voters, the fear of crime, the fear of people with dark skin. The campaign against Anita Earls has been run largely by the North Carolina Republican Party headquarters. And they've sent out mailings that actually darken her skin and make her eyes look robotic and put her next to a gang member who she defended as a defense lawyer. And all of these national themes that you heard President Trump talking about when he was talking about the migration caravan of this fear of criminally intent dark-skinned people invading the country, those themes are being repeated at a state level here right now.
Right. Well, these same themes played out in Virginia in their gubernatorial election last year, where that ended up being a play really hard on the nativist and racist angle. And it didn't work out at all for the Republicans, but it does seem to be a developing theme last year and now Trump going on calling himself a nationalist, by which this is almost certainly a coded appeal to white nationalists.
Oh, sure.
One thing I've noticed in North Carolina, just looking at the polling numbers, is that although the 10 Republican districts are gerrymandered to favor Republicans, because of court actions, they're no longer racial gerrymanders. They're a little weaker than they used to be. And looking at the numbers, there are four districts that were supposed to be safe Republican districts. But if you look at the polling data, Democrats are slightly ahead or even in those four districts. And so there's been a 10 to 23 point swing towards Democrats. And so, you know, who knows what's going to happen in a few weeks. But at least if one looks at the numbers, it looks like, in fact, the national swing in opinion is especially strong in North Carolina. And there, you know, there's a chance that these gerrymandered districts may not actually be as safe for Republicans as one would have thought.
Yeah, I think it's interesting looking, for example, at the Charlotte district, where, you know, Charlotte has been a historically Republican banking city, has been really pretty safe territory for Republicans. But Charlotte is becoming more urban and more diverse. It has a city council that has some pretty activist members. And it was Charlotte, of course, that passed the protections for LGBTQ people that led to the famous House Bill 2, which is often called the bathroom bill, which was an example of what happens when you have a highly partisan legislature that is so gerrymandered that the real fight is in the primaries. And so the extreme edge of the Republican Party is favored. And so this heavy social issues interested Republican Party, you know, comes in and just goes after transgender people. Charlotte was the villain from the Republican point of view, you know, those liberals in Charlotte. And so the city that has always been thought of as a Republican city suddenly is part of this urban movement in North Carolina.
Can I ask one last question, just stepping back? Everything we heard about North Carolina until 2011 didn't point to this kind of politics taking hold in the state. You know, it was moderate bipartisanship, a lot of urban areas. And then this article shows pretty clearly that, as I think Senator Jackson said, North Carolina became a guinea pig for experiments on these kinds of restrictions, and a lot's at stake. Why is it that in a purple state, as they're called, the ferocity has been so intense? How have the Republicans succeeded at doing this at a state that isn't as conservative as others? What explains that?
Well, so as I was interviewing Earls, she noted that when she's talked with her colleagues in Mississippi, they've not had the same sorts of voting rights struggles, and that's partly because they don't have to, because they know that they're safely Republican. When you have a state that is 50-50, it means there's a lot at stake, and even a little bit of shifting the voter base can really make a big difference in terms of outcomes. So the reason that the Republicans gerrymander North Carolina is because they can. They know that you shift a district line by two blocks and you can pretty easily add a Republican seat. That is why you're seeing these fights in places such as Virginia, in places such as Ohio and Wisconsin. This is not either a New York issue or a Mississippi issue.
Yeah, that same thing leaves open avenues for statewide offices like the state Supreme Court office, where if a state is close to 50-50, then both sides have a shot at gaining statewide office, and then that would be a check on the power that the legislature arranges for itself.
Right.
Well, thanks a lot for this conversation, Barry. This was fantastic. Again, our guest was Barry Yeoman, who's a freelance journalist in North Carolina, who's been covering North Carolina politics for many decades now. And we're talking about an article that you can get online on Talking Points Memo: The North Carolina GOP is Trying Every Trick in the Book to Keep a Supreme Court Seat. We urge you to read it. It's a very disturbing and illuminating story. So Barry, thanks for joining the show.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Our next guest is Danielle Thompson, who's a visiting scholar at the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics at Princeton. She's also an assistant professor of political science at the University of California, Irvine, and she has extensive research interests in American politics, political parties, the U.S. Congress, gender, and politics. She's written a book that looks at partisan polarization in Congress with Cambridge University Press. It's called Opting Out of Congress: Partisan Polarization and the Decline of Moderate Candidates, an important story of what's going on in Washington. And she's published extensively in the Journal of Politics, Legislative Studies Quarterly, Political Behavior, and much more. So, Danielle, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
So we were hoping to talk about many parts of the midterm, but one is a big story in terms of how gender might impact the midterms. And 1992 is called the Year of the Woman. That was the election that came after the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, which led to an increase in the number of female senators, and some are wondering whether we might see that again. Can you just start us off by talking a little bit about what we know about the registration and organization of female voters as well as female candidates this year?
Yes. So this is one of the main stories in the election of 2018. I think that people knew a while ago that this was going to be a story. So Emily's List was saying last year that they had over 20,000 women contacting them, expressing an interest in running this year. So it was sort of anticipated a while ago. But if you just look at the numbers, the reason that people are comparing it to 1992 is because of the sheer surge in the number of women candidates. We've seen a record number of women who filed to run for office this year. There were 476, which trounced the previous record of 298 in 2012. Then more than that, we've seen a record number of party nominees, so women who are competing in the general election. So after all the primaries have been decided, we've seen there are 235 women competing in the general elections.
That's for House and Senate?
This is for the House. Sorry
about
that.
Just the House alone.
Yep, this is just the House alone.
Wait, so more than half the candidates
So this is up from the record of 167 in 2016. Mm-hmm. So the main reason for the parallels to 1992 are because of the surge in the number of women who are running, who initially filed, but also the number of women who are competing in the general election this year.
And so does that mean that something like half of the races in the country have at least one woman in the race?
So there are 29% of all major party candidates right now, but 43% of Democratic candidates and 13% of Republican candidates. I should note that these figures are coming from the Center for American Women in Politics, which does a really incredible job of compiling these numbers and making them available for people to follow. But yes, this means that over half of Democratic, or 43% of Democratic nominees are women, which is huge.
And so, for the first time, it's theoretically possible for Congress to be majority women.
Well, no, because they're not running in districts where they could all win.
I said theoretically.
So I would just say no.
All right, Julian.
And you said, you said this really started a while ago now, the organization of this vote. And I remember seeing the article by Theda Scotchpole and her collaborator, Laura Putnam, I think, in Democracy, which dated some of this to right after Trump's election, that you saw this real big interest in mobilization by suburban educated female voters. Is that what we're seeing now a response to the Trump election, or other factors at work that explain why this is happening right now as opposed to 6 years ago or 7 years ago?
Yeah, I think the modal interpretation is that this is a response to Trump. So we saw the surge that I was talking about in terms of expression of interest to Emily's List came right in the wake of the Women's March, which was immediately following the election of Trump. So Trump is certainly the main factor in 2018. But if you do take a more historical look at how Democratic women have fared in the party, it's not new that their numbers have been far greater than the number of Republican women running, and that they've been faring better than not only Republican women but also Democratic men for quite some time. But the huge increase, the striking increase that we've seen this year, is almost certainly because of Trump and women's activism that we've seen by groups, organizations, as well as on the community level, and just friends asking friends to run for office.
And how can I ask? This is a question for those who don't follow politics, but the story you're telling is important. It's dated now in terms of when it starts, and these organizations are helping to make this happen in terms of finding a different kind of group of candidates to run for midterms. Do you know more about how that actually happens? Kind of the nuts and bolts of how those decisions are made, how that recruitment actually takes place, so that you could reach a moment like right now where it's actually different than in most midterms?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways in which people decide to run for Congress. So some are recruited by party leaders. Some have just always wanted to run, and now is a good opportunity for them to run. Research shows that women need to be asked more than men. They need to be recruited more than men. And I think there was a lot of this turning inward toward the community and saying something is not the way that we want it to be right now, and we need to do something. And it has to change. And so a lot of this was local level community activism. Some years it's more party directed, but other years less so. So I think the sheer number, there a lot of anecdotal stories at least have been floating around the news world, so journalist coverage of how candidates decide to run. And a lot of the women who are talking about their decisions say that it's because, they organize with their family, their friends, and community members, and their candidacies were launched that way.
One thing that strikes me is that after the 2016 election, there was a lot of talk about disgruntled working class voters, people who didn't go to college, so white guys who didn't go to college, and then a little spate of news stories about you know, visiting these guys in coal country or in Rust Belt country or what have you. But this other story seems a little undercovered, which is the real delta compared with 2016 since that time has been what appears to be, you know, I live in the suburbs and so maybe I see it more, but this eruption of women, you know, in my community, white women. So like, you know, these women who previously, you know, they voted, they were good citizens, but they're doing a lot more now. There's door knocking and forming associations, exactly. Kind of Tocqueville style. They just all came together and they're ticked off. And they there seems to be a lot more energy. And it strikes me that that's the story that has not yet been fully told.
I completely agree. So I think a lot of this is happening at the grassroots level that you're saying. So, and the other thing, I've looked at the names of a lot of the women who are running this year, and I've sort of to only myself so far. So this is the first time I've called it the year of the Katies. So there's a lot of Katies and Jennifers and Amys, and I think that this is emblematic of the types of women who were motivated and who were most angered by the Trump presidency. So I think that a lot of, you know, there's a lot of white women, and it's this suburban group of Katies who...
Well, some of that is demographic, so names become more and less popular. So maybe in 10 years, if this kind of thing continues, we'll see a bunch of Caitlins running for office, right? So right now we got, that's interesting.
We don't see a year of the Barbaras, for example.
So what about ideology? Either these women or just generally more Democrats? Where is there a shift that's apparent when one looks at them as a group?
Yes. Yeah, so the Democratic women who are running for office are far more liberal than the Democratic men. This is also not new. So most of the Democratic women who've run for Congress, at least for the U.S. House, have been more liberal on average than Democratic men in every election, actually, since 1980. So most of the – there's a couple of different trends that are happening this year. Most of the candidates who are running are coming from the leftward end of the spectrum, so most of the Democrats. There are a handful of interesting moderates that you know, people that have been getting a fair amount of attention, but most of the women are coming from the left end of the spectrum. And most of the first-time candidates are also coming from the left of the spectrum, so which is actually related to the fact that they're the women. So female first-time candidates are the most liberal of all. And it's very hard to see an alternative where if the Democrats do, you know, pick up a fair number of seats, the party isn't going to shift left precisely because of these women. So you might have a handful of moderates who are anchoring, you know, a portion of the party at the center. But if most of these Democratic women who people think are going to win do, in fact, win, the party's probably going to shift leftward as a result.
So if I can pick up on two parts of that. So in the House races, a lot of people are talking about how the purple districts will really determine which way this goes, whether the Democrats do gain a majority, how big it might be. So how does that match up with these candidates being more liberal, more to the left? Are they still going to be very competitive in these purple areas, or will they actually be less competitive than a more centrist Democrat?
Well, I mean, a lot of the story is going to be turnout rather than people crossing over. So I think that even in these purple districts, if Democrats turn out, they're not going to cross over because the Democratic women running are more liberal than maybe they would prefer. So my guess is that even in the purple districts, they might be represented by pretty liberal women if they do win.
And what do you know about how gender as a factor for voters works relative to all the other considerations a voter might make, whether it's about the economy or whether it's just the issue agenda? Is there maybe more than in previous years a value added to, you know, having a female candidate almost as an end in itself in determining how someone will vote?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And a lot of scholars have put a lot of invested a lot of energy in this question. So if we just look at, I'm going to give you some scholarship in a minute, but first just the basics. So the primary win rate is far greater for Democratic women this year than for Democratic men. So it's 53% for Democratic women and 34% for Democratic men. That's for all candidates. If you look at non-incumbents, so you know, running in open seats or challengers, it's 44% of Democratic women who are winning compared to 21% of Democratic men. So all that is to say is this year, Democratic women are more likely to win than Democratic men. That is not new. So this has happened in every election since 1988, that Democratic women have been more likely to win than Democratic men. But stepping back, I think there is something advantageous about being a woman running as a Democrat this year, that is unique to this year compared to other years. So if we look at just 1992, Democratic men were the least likely to win in that year, and their levels of winning, their win rates were as low as they are this year. So about 20% of Democratic men were winning their primaries compared to this year, about 28-ish% of Democratic men as well. So Democratic women are faring very well. Turning to the scholarship, though, the ways in which voters cast their ballot. So most of the research has settled on the conclusion that gender is not a huge factor in voter decision making. So other factors, namely party and incumbency, are far more influential in voter decision making than the gender of the candidate. Scholars who have looked at this have shown that there is one exception to this, which is 1992, when voters were slightly, not hugely, but slightly more likely to vote for a woman that year. So I think, given these other parallels that I was just talking about, comparing 1992 to 2018, we could see voters being more likely to cast their ballots in favor of women candidates because they are women, or at least related to the fact that they are women in ways that we don't usually see in congressional elections. Congressional elections are vote choice. It's usually determined by party and incumbency.
Well, one difficulty with scholarship is that scholarship, in order to reach statistical power, takes lots of elections and says, let's look at the numbers and let's not worry about specific conditions. But it's pretty obvious from the current news environment over the last year and a half, when you have Donald Trump talking about, I mean, I can't even say some of these things he says because I live in a sheltered environment where it's just not polite to say such things, where he wants to grab women by the whatever, and just things he said to Megyn Kelly, and then we have the Kavanaugh hearing. We have all these things that just, you know, they just push the gender button really hard. They push it so hard that it breaks. And so whether it's changing women's or men's voters' minds or whether it's increasing turnout, there's something that was apparent from the beginning, right from that giant women's march in Washington immediately afterwards. So it feels like something's a little different. Now I know that you've crunched numbers about how many of these women are likely to be elected. So especially compared with the year of the woman, 1992, what looks likely to happen in terms of how many of these women will eventually attain office in Congress?
Yeah, so in 1982, there was an increase of 19 women in the House that year. So the numbers went from 28 to 47. Currently, there are 84 women in Congress, 61 Democrats and 23 Republicans. If women win all districts where a woman is favored, there are only 90 women elected. And if women win in half of the districts that are rated as toss-ups, there's going to be 98 women. So that would mean an increase of 14 women in Congress, which is huge. So we haven't seen an increase like this since 1992, and the single largest increase since that time was 8 women in 2004. So I think this is going to be, I mean, even a pretty conservative estimate of all the women who are favored and then half the women in toss-up districts, not including the ones that might eke by in districts where they're not favored to win. So it looks to me like this is going to be quite a year that could, you know, compare to 92.
And then so the flip side would be wondering how gender works with the male vote. And obviously the Republican Party, certainly President Trump, is trying to drive that white male vote up. Do you know anything about how that might be related? Is it possible that the large number of female candidates running used by the Republican Party as a way to kind of mobilize the male vote. Is there any dynamic like that that might actually undercut some of what the Democrats are trying to do?
Well, it's possible, and it seems to be like some Republican candidates are trying to use gender in a way that would help them. So I think we've seen this mostly with Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. So her support of, or her vote against Kavanaugh has been used against her in a lot of the advertisements there. So it's certainly possible that many of the Republican men who are running will try to use this against the Democrats in general. But I think, I mean, what Sam was saying about how something being different this year, if there is something different that seems to be on the side of the women running, but whether there's a backlash, I mean, we've seen this happen many times in American politics. So I would certainly leave open that possibility.
Well, if you look at, actually, there's a recent survey from that was released on NBC quite recently showing that propensity to vote, people expressing on a scale from 1 to 10, a 9 or a 10 interest in voting this year among women, it's up in ways, and they're ahead of men, and that's unusual, and they're above 70%. So there seems to be a lot of engagement by women, at least as measured by that recent NBC poll.
That's very interesting.
And is there any change in engagement with Republican women voters?
So most of the story for women is happening on the Democratic side. Republicans in general, identity is not a huge factor in their campaigns or in the reasons that most of the vote, most Republican voters vote. So they, as a party, eschew identity much more than Democrats. And as a result, you don't really see identity as a motivational factor.
Gender identity.
Yeah.
What about white identity?
Wouldn't be a fall
not white identity, but gender identity. Voter. Yes.
There wouldn't be any kind of fall off that you can see of female Republican voters who are turning away from having President Trump as the head of the party, that partisanship is stronger than that in terms of keeping same levels of voting this year as you had a couple years ago and before that?
My hunch is that Republican women will turn out in similar rates, but that is an open possibility.
Yeah.
Because they're not really driven to the polls by the same, you know, by the gender of the candidate or and I'm not sure if they're put off. I'm talking about the Republican women who vote Republican every year. I'm not sure they're turned off by, you know, Trump in a way that would change their vote choice.
Have there been any specific promises made by any of these women? It feels like since it's an upwelling from across the country, that seems like there might not be a unified message. But on the other hand, once we're getting into the territory of 98 legislators, mostly Democrats, one could imagine certain issues becoming more prominent. So, for example, I know in 2016, Rebecca Traister followed around Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. And despite the fact that the national news was filled with stories about her email, I asked Traister, well, what do you think that Clinton would do as president? And the first thing out of her mouth was women's and children's issues. And it was a thing that just didn't make it into the national news, didn't come up. I wonder if there are themes that have arisen among these candidates' positions, what they talk about when they're on the trail, that we're going to be hearing more about in if they come to power, and let's say hypothetically if the Democrats retake the House.
Yeah, so there are really stark differences in the issue, unsurprisingly, that the issues that Democratic and Republican women promote in Congress. So party is a huge factor and ideology is a huge factor in the types of issues that they pursue. One interesting thing I think about the Democratic women who have been running this year is they are, despite most of them being quite liberal, they are pretty diverse in terms of their background. So some of them have military backgrounds, some of them have legal backgrounds, some of them have community organizing backgrounds. And I think as a result, we're going to see if these women get elected, we're going to see a lot of differences in the types of issues they pursue. So my hunch would be that the women with military backgrounds will be more interested in veterans affairs. The women with backgrounds in community organizing might be more interested in sort of traditional women's issues like healthcare, education, maybe reproductive policy. But I'm not sure there's going to be sort of one you know, a small set of issues, just given the diversity in the backgrounds and their paths to office that we've seen from the women this year.
Well, I guess near us, we have here in New Jersey, we've got Mickey Sherrill, who looks to be ahead by about, I think last I checked, about 10 points. And so it seems like she's likely to go to Washington. And she would be in that category of someone favoring military affairs. This is interesting. I should, by the way, interject that when you look at toss-up races, it appears that Democrats are tied or leading in a majority of those. And so it looks like your estimate of half the toss-up races going Democrats' way would be probably not too far off.
I just saw the other day that of the 46 races that Cook Political Report at that time had included as toss-ups, 63% of them at Whole Foods, and they were using this as
Dave Wasserman of Cook Political Report said that Democrats are doing really great in places that are within 20 minutes of a Whole Foods. Ironic, because Whole Foods is actually owned by conservatives and is in fact basically a source of profits for the right.
But it's a good proxy.
So if we're almost out of time, but if we're just now looking ahead and we're a few weeks away from the election, based on everything you have told us and your studies, you are feeling as much as one can feel. But you have a good sense that the predictions that the kind of surge of female candidates within the Democratic Party, organization and mobilization of female voters, can have a significant impact in November, certainly on the composition of the House and even on the ideological direction of the Democratic Party, moving it a little further to the left. But it's looking as if those predictions are based on some pretty solid empirical findings. Is that accurate?
I think this is going to be a good year for the election of women to Congress. If I just have a couple,
and that's whether whether Democrats take Congress back or not. That's still going to be true, probably.
Probably.
Okay. Anyway, you were saying.
The other downstream consequences of this, I think there's a couple. So one concern about the number of women running this year is that it could deter women from running in the future. So if a lot of the women running this year lose because they're running as challengers or in tougher races, that it's going to turn them off from politics in a way that will be detrimental in the future, that it's going to have these unintended lasting sort of negative consequences. So for some other research, I was looking at who the losers and whether, so congressional losers from 1980 to 2014, and whether male and female losers are equally likely to run again if they lose. And in every year, there was no gender difference in the candidates who lose whether or not they run again. So after accounting for all of these other things that matter, like the number of candidates in the race, money, a bunch of factors, women who lose are not less likely to, get back up and try again. And we've seen this in close elections, which are particularly important. So I think that is really good for the women running this year. So even if they lose, they might run again at either the congressional level or the state legislative or local level. The other aspect of this that has lasting consequences, I think, is when a large number of women is elected in a certain year, what this means in 10, 20, 30 years down the road is that some women are going to be better situated to advance within the chamber and within the party. So of the women, I think a pretty striking fact is of the women, the Republican women serving in Congress today, there's 23 of them. Only two of them have been in office since before 2000. So one is Ileana Ross-Leighton, who's retiring this year, and the other is Kay Granger of Texas. If you look at the Democrats, in large part because of 1992, about a third of the women in their caucus right now have been in office since prior to 2000. And so they've been able to advance and move up within the party and chamber as a result. So I think these are two really good long-term effects of this, I would say not so simple, but of just the surge in the number of women who are running this year.
I'm intrigued by the idea that somehow women would be discouraged from running again if they lose. Somehow I don't remember hearing this concern when men lose, but
exactly.
But there's
yeah.
I think I want to linger on that just a moment. Okay, that's interesting.
I think we're actually out of time. But Danielle, thanks so much for joining our show. Again, this is Danielle Thompson, who's currently at Princeton at the Center for the Study of Democratic Politics, an assistant professor of political science at UC Irvine, and the author of Partisan Polarization and the Decline of Moderate Candidates with Cambridge University Press. Thanks so much for joining our show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for joining the show and the discussion. Thanks again to Danielle and Barry for a terrific episode. Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.